going to continue to drift in as the snack bar lines shorten, I think we should get underway, because I intend to end promptly at 9:30. So let me introduce myself and talk a little bit about the forum and tonight's topic and begin. So I think we can roll the tape. Tonight's forum is entitled War and Patriotism. My name is Mark Schwain, and I serve the village as the summer teaching staff coordinator along with my wife Dorothy Bass. And part of what I do in that work is to moderate the Holden Forums, which normally take place a couple of evenings each week. Tonight, we've chosen a subject which is complex and difficult, although most of our topics are complex and difficult. But we chose this one to point us forward toward the 4th of July celebration that's coming up on Saturday, and thought we would, in connection with that celebration, ask ourselves some questions about patriotism. What is it? To what extent does it depend for its character and its intensity on enemies or perceived enemies or warfare? We heard a homily earlier this week on a different subject from Christine Carlson, talking about the floods in Minneapolis and how people bound together with a specially intense sense of hospitality and civic cooperation in the face of this kind of adversary. In this case, it was the river, in a way, a natural phenomenon. And we've had an American philosopher, William James, who wrote a famous essay called The Moral Equivalent of War in the Aftermath of the Earthquake in Palo Alto, California, which took place when he was there teaching, when he noticed that people seemed to draw together in community and take a special measure of pride and mutual endeavor and mutual love in the face of an adversary, the earthquake and its aftermath. And that led him to wonder whether or not it wasn't in some sense always necessary for entire nations to either be at war or think that it was the threat of one in order to sustain a sense of patriotism, or, as the dictionary defines it, love of country and support of its interest in a devoted way. We're fortunate to have a number of villagers here with us this evening to kind of start us off, to engage a bit in reminiscence, if they choose, a bit in a kind of comment on their own sense of patriotism, what it once may have been and what it is now. And we've tried to put forward a variety of folks to speak just briefly about this. Three of them are veterans, and I'm going to introduce the panelists first and then call on them one by one. And when they're finished, invite everybody to join in. The point of Holden Forums is to explore together some serious question, and that's basically what we're set out to do this evening: help each other get a richer sense of what patriotism is, what it might be, and where we as Christians fit into that whole notion. So I want to thank in advance the five folks who've agreed to say a few words and ask them to raise their hand when I introduce them, and I'll say a little bit about them. First of all, Bob Lilly. Bob is a veteran of the United States Air Force and served in World War II and has been to Holden several times. Jack Robinette. Jack is a veteran as well, also of World War II, where he served in the United States Navy, and he may tell you a little bit about that, some of his memories. Bud Krickmer, over here. Bud was an enlisted man in the Korean War, and then a commissioned officer in the Vietnam War. two very different wars, as he told me, and his experience is very different when we met together earlier in the week. Then we have Christine Carlson with us, and I'm sure many of you have already enjoyed her sessions here at the Village. She's coming to the end of her second week here. First week she did Bible study, and this week she and her husband, Mari Wee, are doing theological sessions on the practical ways to practice our faith. And she has, among other things, lived outside of this country for 3 years and has had a perspective on it from outside, and she'll tell you about that. And then we have a new villager who is on volunteer staff with us, Rachel Westermeyer, who comes to us from Minneapolis and who served a stint in Lutheran Volunteer Corps and is now at work. What kind of work is it that you do now?
Mental health worker, basically.
So we have a range of experiences and perspectives on this question, and I think we'll just begin then arbitrarily with Bob and have you share with us a bit of your story and your sense of patriotism.
Thank you. I listened to your definition of patriotism. Also, I looked it up today. Similarly, found some of the same things you did were mentioned as characteristic. But something else that you did mention, that this word patriotism is a German derivative of it, and it's fatherland. And I think that's kind of significant, going back to WW2, fighting the war, at least was one of the enemies being Germany. I want to preface, if I may, very briefly, going in, planning to go into the service. I thought it might help me to at least get a little experience out of my home territory. Went to Milwaukee and worked, got a job working at Allen's Chalmers, which made tractors at that, well, previously, and now we're making M4 tanks for the Army. That was quite an experience, and not knowing what side of the fence I should be on all this, but just 17, I needed a job and did my thing, but there was a lot of patriotism among the people that were there, that we had a job to do and we had to do whatever was given to us to do. Be that as it may, I went into the military and the Air Force in the spring of 1944. Yeah. And was trained for eventual combat on a B-17 as a gunner. And went overseas to England and again had more training. And eventually I was my title was changed from a gunner. I was transferred into the role as the Togaleer, which meant I was an enlisted bombardier on the B-17. That was quite a change, ladies and gentlemen. You know, from that kind of devastating thing that I had to accept as a role in the military. Scared as I was. I was needed to be trained, knowing how to drop bombs, which I did in practice going over the English Channel. And the next day that we were going to go out on our first mission was the end of World War II in Germany. And thank God for answering prayers. Following this, I just want to make a mention too about patriotism, and that is, I think it was, in my opinion, at my age, the peak was the World War II days. It was very, very strong, but since then, I've seen subsequent wars where I felt there were struggles more and more for, let's not go into wars, naturally. Hostility to going into wars, draft dodgers, the whole bit, seemed to just escalate And I couldn't figure out what was happening to patriotism. And I still haven't really figured it out. It's still a nebulous factor in my life. And I don't know how we're going to ever gain it again, unless there's a major war. We do have catastrophes, and as you mentioned, that have helped to solidify people, but it's only for a short term again. So I'm just saying, it's a mixed up bag for me in knowing how we're going to begin solidifying the country. Get better.
Okay, so in your lifetime, you've had experiences where you say this suggest that the peak of patriotic feeling in your experience was World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And that you too think that there's some evidence to suggest that war and patriotism are connected, but not in a simple way, in that we've had other wars, and they haven't necessarily correlated with increasing patriotism. Sometimes they've been the source of division more than unity, and you're wondering whether or not patriotism as that kind of sentiment is waning, and whether short of some kind of collective sense of an enemy or a catastrophe, it can be fully rebuffed. Well, let's hear from somebody then who's only recently begun to think about these matters. And I'm thinking now of Rachel, who has just joined Lawns and Gardens here at Holden Village. And why don't you just say a few words about your sense of what patriotism might be or what you think it might be?
Well, I guess when Mark asked me to do this, my first reaction was, well, I don't think about patriotism at all, sort of like what you're mentioning here. So I enlisted a couple of my friends here. I think what you sort of wanted was an idea of what is like Generation X sort of thinking of patriotism. And we talked about it quite a bit. Mel is a teacher, and she said she's thought about it, this is Mel right here, quite a bit this year. She's a high school teacher and has noticed that a lot of the students that she teaches to are not even sort of disrespectful in some respects when, you know, doing the Pledge of Allegiance or singing the national anthem at games or whatever. And we're sort of trying to figure out what it is. What is it that makes us, well, that's different. I don't think that we necessarily consider ourselves to be non-patriotic, but just maybe not really thinking of it. And I think, from our perspective, not having lived through, you know, World War II or some of the eras where it was intense patriotism, what we've sort of noticed in our lifetime is sort of this distrust of government and not only distrust but questioning systems and government, and, you know, seen a lot of like sort of different conspiracies, and this whole conspiracy theory factor has sort of come in, I guess. Surrounding Vietnam and then the whole Kennedy assassination. I mean, there's just been, you know, historical event after historical event, but I think we have grown up, and I mean, even just talking about in history, we really didn't learn much about like Vietnam War. It was sort of just glossed over, if talked about at all. And then what we learned about it from that was what we were told by our parents or by, you know, whoever. And I think that's caused a certain amount of distrust of government, I would say, is what maybe has caused some of the non-patriotism, I guess. The other thing that I wanted to point out was that there hasn't been any major war during my lifetime, really, besides the Gulf War, which I think I do remember noticing a bit of a surge of patriotism at that time. However, it was short because it was a short-lived war. So I guess my feeling is sort of, yeah, I don't know that it will come. We will get that feeling again until there is that sort of emergency sense. And I think that from what I know of American history, which isn't all that much, World War II, American people were very supportive of being in that war. And subsequent wars, maybe that hasn't been always the case. So I think that definitely has takes part. And I guess also the other only other thing I wanted to say was my feeling on patriotism, I guess the way that I traveled last year in Europe quite a bit, and what I noticed was that people were sort of resentful of Americans in a lot of respects, so it wasn't, you weren't necessarily supposed to be proud of being American, and a lot of the Canadians that I met were traveling with, and clearly making it known that they were Canadian and not American, because they always had the maple leaf on their flag, or maybe on their backpack. So that's another thing, I guess, in this world order, we're sort of the leader, but I think that other countries see us as not always being that socially responsible, or politically responsible, I guess, I don't know, or hypocritical. So I guess the way that I try to be patriotic is probably more locally, by getting involved in local political things and buying locally, supporting local businesses, whatever, and volunteering. That's
my... Well, thank you. Thank you. That's very helpful. I think it helps to confirm what Bob was saying was his sense, that the extent of patriotism isn't very broad and deep. It helps to give us a variation in your own experience of the think globally and act locally. Yours is sort of think nationally and act locally, maybe. And also begin to unpack a few of the reasons, in your judgment, a kind of waning of confidence in American institutions, specifically the government. And political institutions might account for this in your experience. Well, let's turn to Bud now, because Bud is an interesting transitional figure between World War II, which we heard from first, and the present day, in that he served in both the Korean War and in Vietnam. And when we first met, I should say, Bud was very keen to have me indicate that though he's going to talk about patriotism, he wants this distinguished very sharply from jingoism, which is a kind of aggressive and bellicose form of chauvinism. He has no part of that and thinks it's important that we get up front the distinction between that and patriotism, which is a love of country, which can be a critical love of country at times. So having done that, let me just turn to Bud and invite you, Bud, to share a little bit about your experience.
Well, these old timers, I was 15, 16 when World War II ended. So when I joined the Army, it wasn't for a sense of patriotism, it was an adventure. I was, nothing could kill me. I was that age, 17, 18. And the first real assignment I had was at Camp Lee, Virginia, which was the WAC Training Center. A 20-year-old single male could throw me in a briar patch. Patriotism, I sure could add a lot of it. But as time went on, and the United States didn't win wars, people don't like losers. And if you notice the voting record, back in the 30s it was much better. Now we get 50% turnout, think we have a high turnout of voters. Patriotism is voting, as far as I'm concerned, and taking part, like your senator, letting your congressman know what you like and dislike. And then when he goes against you, find out why. Because if you're I live in a small town, so when I came back from Vietnam, or in there, and I, the church people were not against us. They weren't against the common soldier. They were against the government in there. Jane Fonda was on church, and so was her husband, so we didn't have to worry about them. But as later as I got on in the military, I ended up as Inspector General, which military people know what that is. We dealt with the problems, the gays that came in to see us because they were still in the service, they were being harassed, and they wanted out. The conscientious objectors who took their draft home and found out they're conscientious objectors. Who hasn't changed their mind? And I learned to like these people and respect them. I think the conscientious objector is as patriotic as anybody. Because they stood, and they stood their ground, and they took the punishment for being it. The people ran to Canada or went to England to school. I don't consider them patriotic at all. They were draft evaders. Yeah, you know who I'm referring to. And then they send our troops off to war, people who never served in it. War is not pleasant. I spent 30 years in the active Army and Reserve. And I guess 2 days of that was actual, maybe 2 or 3 days was actual under fire, mortar rounds and stuff like that. Tet 68 was one of them. And needless to say, I didn't feel very patriotic. I felt more scared than anything. I just functioned, though I was scared. But I just think being an American is protecting. I've seen a lot of countries like you, and I think there's great things to say about every country. But I haven't seen anything overall better than here. This country is pretty good. We've got our faults, and right now we got more than we've ever had. And I've been stationed at Atomic Energy Works. I was a nuclear missile system, whether we had nuclear missiles or not was never important because we treated everything like it was nuclear. I've been an artillery officer, but my staff time, because I wasn't a regular Army officer, I ended up always as a logistics type. And in Vietnam, I took care of all the ammunition for the 3rd Corps area, which is the 2nd Field Force. And we never had nerve gas that I know of, because I never had it on my list. And they were top secret list. So I can't tell you what's on there, but I can tell you that wasn't on there. So I hear some of these stories, but I just think patriotism is just letting your wants and desires known as what you expect from your government.
Okay, thank you. I take it that in a way the difference between you and Bob is that in your case, you experienced a certain wave of patriotism working in the plant, making the tanks, which kind of not necessarily led you into the service, but was already there before you went. And in your case, you entered the service for out of a sense of adventure, and gradually that leads you to a sense of patriotism, which you define as basically civic participation, particularly in the political process by voting and so on. Thank you. Okay, Christine.
Oh, all right. Mark asked me to reflect on what living in another country. I lived in Canada for 3 years, which is different, but not, it was more different than I anticipated. So that is what I'd like to reflect on, what that experience taught me, and what I learned from that about patriotism. But I just thought I'd reflect a little bit. It was interesting, I was thinking about the meaning of the word patriotism too today, and since it's fatherland, I was thinking also of matriotism, my motherland. And so I thought I'd just reflect a bit, just briefly, about my parents and that what I got from my father and from my mother. Just to back up a bit, my grandparents were just about all immigrants to this country from Germany and from Norway. And for them, it was there was nothing for them in Germany. There was nothing for them in Norway. They were second and third children, fourth, fifth, sixth children in large families. And there was nothing for them. So they came to this country sort of with the clothes on their backs, and what they sought was education. And that was a big priority for them. My father grew up abroad. He grew up in Madagascar as a child of missionaries. And for him, I think growing up abroad, America was magic. He thought American kids were just so much better than he was. They traded baseball cards and chewed chewing gum. And so I've sensed sometimes in my father this inferiority sense that America was great and he didn't grow up here. And so when he came to this country as a 17-year-old, he had some things to find out about this country and himself. He was in the Navy in the Second World War. He was an ensign, and his goal was to be a pilot. He's 6'5", though he was too tall for the airplanes that they were designing at that time. And so he wasn't able to pursue that, and so he studied Japanese for 2 years and was used in wrapping up the war over in Guam, on Guam, with his Japanese language skills. For him, I think being in the Second World War was a way to discover what it meant to be an American and to become an American himself. And he's still very proud of that time. My mother, the matriotism I grew up with, my mother comes from a complex, or a family of a somewhat diverse background, but a strong Quaker pacifist influence in my mother's family. And two of her cousins were conscientious objectors in the Second World War and were jailed, spent time in internment camps as conscientious objectors during that time. And so that's what came together when my folks married. And the Vietnam War was the event that brought them together finally. And my father struggled deeply as a proud veteran of the Second World War. He struggled deeply and finally was involved in the peace movement in the Vietnam era. And my mother, from her background, fell kind of naturally into that, I think. So I was a teenager growing up during that time and became involved myself. So when I moved to Canada when I was 23 years old, it was with this mixture of mixed feelings about my country and very mostly critical feelings, I think, as an American just coming off of the Vietnam War effort and glad to see that war winding down, and then Watergate just after that. It was a cynical time in the American culture. Moving to Canada was just an eye-opening kind of experience for me. I knew nothing about Canada when I moved up there. I was a landed immigrant there for 3 years. And the thing that struck me first was how how dominant American business and American culture was there, and how in some ways the Canadian culture depended on that for commerce and for military protection, and also how resentful forces were in American culture toward Americans. And so those 3 years, I guess, just to reflect about living abroad as another way to gain insight into patriotism or matriotism. It proved very much to be that way for me, that living in Canada gave me perspectives on America as a dominating kind of culture, but it also that were hard to see and caused me to be critical more of my country. But also, it was a maturing time for me to realize I am a citizen of America and I am American, and to claim that and find a way to be proud of that as much as I was struggling with it also. So I'll be quiet there.
Well, that's fine. Thank you.
That's what I wanted to offer.
Thank you very much. So in a way, would it be putting words in your mouth to say that though you left here to live in Canada with in the aftermath of not only Vietnam but Watergate, and had quite negative or critical feelings about your country, that living among the Canadians who themselves were frequently even more critical, that in a sense it didn't make you so much defensive as it did make you realize kind of an identity, a shock of recognition, who you are, that your roots, however mixed those may be, given the different streams that fed into your family, that still was who you were.
Mm-hmm. It was a maturing time for me, and getting a perspective on this country, and claiming it more and more as my own, in a way that I had struggled to do before.
Mm-hmm. Good. Thank you. Jack, you're going to have the last word among our first five. Jack was a veteran of the United States Navy and served at the very end of World War II.
Thank you, Mark. I'll turn around here a little bit. I'm from Pullman, Washington. I'm a retired professor of veterinary surgery at the Veterinary School in Pullman, a small town about 80 miles south of Spokane. When I came to Holden this week, I brought the current issue of National Geographic with me. And it has an insert on it called Natural Hazards of North America. And Christine touched on this the other night about the flood of the Red River. And I'm just going to pass this around. You can look at it if you like. I'd like to have it back when it's all over. I think the examples given in this are show patriotism for our country on a short-term basis. A flood, a Hurricane Andrew, a tornado, an earthquake, it has it all there. A child falls down a well, the whole country pulls together for a day or two or three, and then the youngster's out and everything's fine and you move on to something else. But Mark specifically asked me to talk about patriotism as I saw it in the World War II years, and I thought about that and I thought, hey, I'm glad to do that. So I sat out at the Ark later that same day. No, it was early the next morning, and I wrote down a page of notes, some things that I think were important about that and didn't want to forget. And so I'll glance at these occasionally as I talk to you. And my earliest remembrance, I was just a boy living in southern Idaho when the Germans were moving into Europe in their early phases of World War II, and the Japanese were moving into China. And every morning, Dad's little radio would come on, and as a youngster, I would hear about the war in China with the Japanese, and I would hear then about the war in Europe with the Germans marching into Austria. And that was my earliest observations, I guess. I must say that I think there was a rather casual, ho-hum interest in the United States of America about the impending World War II back in the late 30s. At that time, the United States was very much an isolationist nation. And I must say that the famous William Senator Borah from my home state of Idaho led the charge in that regard. They tried to make us an isolationist nation. We're going to stay out of this. We don't have anything to do with it. As I recall, the Conscription Act, the draft, was passed by a very, very narrow vote. I can still see newsreel pictures of the Secretary of War reaching in and pulling the first number out of the fishbowl, but it just barely passed in 1940, something like that. I'll tell you when I think patriotism hit the United States right between the eyes, and that was with the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. To me, there's no question, but that's what brought it all about. And it was Sunday, December 7th, 1941. And as a young boy, I think I was a freshman in high school in a small town in southern Idaho, close to Sun Valley. We were all gathered the next day on Monday in Assembly Hall. And President Roosevelt's speech to a joint session of Congress came on. And I remember to my dying day what he said. And he said, Sunday, December 7th, 1941, a day that will live in infamy. He went on to describe the attack and our terrible losses, some 3,000 men. The Arizona still sitting on the bottom of Pearl Harbor. And then he said before this joint session of Congress, I ask that the Congress declare that a state of war has existed since that attack. And they declared that state of war, the Congress did, unanimously, minus one vote. There's one person that didn't, because he said, well, just didn't seem like it should be 100%. That drew the country together. There's some other ways at that time of, I think, how our country showed patriotism. The next day, after Roosevelt made that speech, recruiting offices all over the country were overwhelmed with long lines of people trying to enlist. Army, Navy, Marines, all the families that had someone serving in the service put a star in their window. The star changed color if they were killed, but everybody supported the war effort that way. Women joined the labor force. The term was Rosie the Riveter. They went off to the seacoast to build ships. They went off to Boeing to build airplanes. They went everywhere. And they left the job as homemaker and became Rosie the Riveter. The thing that really hit everybody and really made you think that the war was on was rationing. Gasoline was rationed. You couldn't get gasoline. You couldn't get rubber tires for your cars. They weren't building any cars. All they were building was Jeeps and tanks and airplanes. There were no cars made in the first half of the 1940s whatsoever. Synthetic rubber was invented. Couldn't get rubber because the Japanese had taken all the islands where rubber was obtained. So they made synthetic rubber. Meat was rationed, sugar was rationed, shoes were rationed. You just couldn't get anything. But we didn't starve to death. We all did pretty well, really. Then there were war bonds. There was a great effort on selling war bonds and trying to finance this war. Young school kids would go to school and they'd sell stamps, one at a time, 10 cents a piece. And you'd get your little booklet like this filled up with stamps, then you could convert it to a bond. And the Hollywood got behind the effort, 100%. The movie stars got into it, and they'd go around and promote the sale of war bonds, and they'd put on benefits. They'd go to the USOs and put on shows and this sort of thing. And I remember two very famous songs that brought out patriotism in World War II. One was Let's Remember Pearl Harbor. Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we did the Alamo. And it goes on and on and on. And another one was Praise the Lord and Pass the Ammunition. There was a chaplain on board one of the ships that was attacked in Pearl Harbor. And some of the gun crew was wiped out, didn't have enough to put the shells up to shoot the AK-AK guns at the Japanese planes still coming over. And their old chaplain was, hand me that shell, praise the Lord, and pass the ammunition. And as a school kid then, we had left this little town in Southern Idaho, moved back to Boise, the capital. We rode our bicycles to school, and my two friends and I had all joined the service right after graduation. Go down the road singing, praise the Lord and pass the ammunition, all the way riding our bikes to high school. I'm telling you, there was a lot of patriotism back then. There really was. If you were 4F or you knew anybody was, that was just the worst stigma that could possibly be mentioned. Nobody wanted to be 4F. I tell you, Jay Leno would have the biggest fun with that today. He'd make more fun of a 4F person than he is Bill Clinton. By today's standard, he just really raked that one up and down the coals.
Tell us what 4F is.
Beg your pardon?
What was 4F? What that
means? Oh, I'm sorry. 4F meant you were ineligible for some physical reason to get in the draft, most of which was legitimate, but you'd be surprised how many people tried to wiggle out of it.
Flat feet. Flat feet.
Yeah, flat feet. Anyway, that was 4F. Thank you for mentioning that. That was really something. From Washington State University, I told you where I was from. How many have heard of Edward R. Murrow? Great broadcaster for CBS. Edward R. Murrow was over in London. He'd come on to the evening news every night. And when you say, this is London. He had that beautiful, marvelous voice, one that's never been equaled yet on the radio, in my opinion. That brought you home with the war. There were neighborhood wardens. They'd go around, have little bands on their shoulders. They'd go around, they'd be sure you had your lights out, particularly on the seacoast, because they were afraid the Japanese subs were going to come and bomb LA, bomb San Francisco, and that sort of thing. And they had blackouts, even as far inland as certain parts of Idaho that I was in. You could rarely go to church, but the minister didn't talk about in his sermon something about the war effort, almost invariably, every Sunday, in some way or other. A little word or two on my personal experiences in the war. I enlisted in the Navy right out of high school. I was 17 years old. I trained at the Naval Training Station over at Farragut, Idaho, about 300 miles from right here in North Idaho. There were only three in the nation then, Farragut, San Diego, and the Great Lakes Naval Training Center back east. And I liked it. I liked it a lot. And I put in for battleship duty after I finished boot camp. And I went aboard the USS New Mexico in Leyte Gulf Harbor in the Philippines. And she had just come back from the Okinawa campaign where the Japanese, being desperate, had started their kamikaze attacks. And that means that the pilot would charge his plane right into the side of one of our naval ships. He obviously committed suicide in the attack, and it was becoming more and more common. And I replaced a young man that got killed from one of those kamikaze attacks when I went aboard the battleship. Well, kind of like you, I got in at the tail end of the war, and we're on our way back to Pearl Harbor. It was the latter part of July, 1945. We were going to have the guns relying for the impending attack and invasion of Japan itself, which was scheduled for November. We got a change of orders, because all of a sudden in the ship newspaper it says atomic bomb falls on Hiroshima. Our orders changed, we put into Saipan, and on my birthday, the Japanese surrendered, and I was sitting in Saipan. A month later, I'm in a convoy sitting in Tokyo Bay on my battleship. General Douglas MacArthur is around the corner in Tokyo Bay signing the peace surrender terms with the Japanese. I still have a picture of my ship with Mount Fujiyama in the background, a great picture that I cherish a great deal. A couple final reflections, probably more personal than anything else. But that was patriotism back then. Then along came the Korean War, and I think President Truman made a mistake when he called it a police action, but nevertheless, that's what he called it. And we had boys over there getting killed, that's for sure. But then later the Vietnam War came along, and there just wasn't, in my opinion, the same degree of patriotism, didn't even come close to support either of those wars, Korea or Vietnam, that we had in World War II. Now maybe Truman's word police action or something was it, but the country was not behind either of those things. The country was divisive. And although I enlisted in World War II, and I'd enlist tomorrow if we had another Pearl Harbor type war, I wouldn't have served in either of those willingly. I don't blame Bill Clinton or anybody else that tried to get out of it, because I wouldn't want to fight for my country if I didn't think my country was supporting me. There's never any doubt in World War II, but there sure wasn't those other two. I felt that way about it. Finally, I get blubbery yet when I think a couple of the war heroes. I'll go back to World War I and Sergeant York. I don't know how many of you have ever seen the movie with Gary Cooper in it. He played the part of Sergeant York, the most decorated hero we had to come out of World War I. Here was a guy that was a conscientious objector because of religious beliefs, but nevertheless, they took him in. Finally, had a talk with his captain. He says, "Well, Alvin York, do you think you could shoot somebody?" "Well, I don't know yet whether I could or not." But he got over there in combat, and his friends were falling all around him, and all of a sudden he picked up his rifle and went around them just like he would a flock of turkeys back in the Tennessee farm, and he started picking off Germans. And before he got back, he captured over 200, brought them back, and it was kind of overwhelmed everybody. And his captain eventually asked him, he said, "Well, didn't you have trouble shooting them?" He said, "Well, Captain, I'll tell you, it was like this. I figured that they were shooting dozens of us, maybe hundreds. If I could get some of them and prevent that killing," he said, "that's how I justified it, being a good Christian and a conscientious objector prior to that." And when they, in the movie version, of course, when they hung that Congressional Medal of Honor around his neck, I still get a lump in my throat when I see that, as I do when I think of Audie Murphy, the most decorated combat soldier in the history of American warfare. He went through World War II. He won every decoration for valor that this country could bestow, every single one. And he got the Congressional Medal of Honor, and I get a lump in my throat when I hear that play. And finally, you think yourself, "Well, you're a Christian, could I fight?" And I was thinking today, when the girl this noon was telling us about the young lady that was tortured and raped and so on, I thought, well, now, if I was standing there and had a gun in my hand and I had a chance to get those guys, I wouldn't hesitate a minute to pick them off, to protect her rights and everything else that goes along with it. Reminds me of the story that General Patton told in World War II. He said, "Some of you, I think, are wondering if you're going to chicken out under combat and you won't be able to do the job." He said, "Don't worry about it. When you put your hand over into that mass of goo that a minute ago was your friend's best face, you'll know what to do." That's exactly what he said. And finally, I'll leave you with this thought. General MacArthur was recalled from the Korean War because he had won the battle at Incheon and to stop the North Koreans, and then the Chinese Communists came in and he wanted to bomb north of Yalu. Well, for that and other political reasons, President Truman recalled him and he replaced him with General Ridgway. And General MacArthur was like Martin Luther King in a way. He was an outstanding orator. In my opinion, one of the most outstanding orators that this century has ever produced. And he was addressing a joint session of Congress. And he ended his speech by reflecting back to when he was a plebe on the plains of West Point. And he said, "I'm reminded of an old barrack song that we used to sing, and it goes like this, that old soldiers never die, they just fade away." And he said, "Like that old soldier, I now close my 52 years of military service and just fade away. An old soldier that tried to do his duty as God gave him the light to see that duty." Now, I always thought that the general was appealing to a higher authority than President Truman, but nevertheless, so much for my speech.
Thank you. Seems to me we've heard a lot to suggest from our speakers that this whole notion that suggested in the title of our forum that there is a connection between war and patriotism. There may be something to that. I mean, we've heard World War II cited more than once as having been some period in our past when there was a deep, wide, pervasive love of country, and that since then, that seems to have dissipated or unraveled or diminished. I invite other people to comment on that thought or anything anybody else said or anything you might have to offer on what patriotism is.
Well, one of the things in Vietnam, they tried to run like a corporation instead of like the military. We had body counts. In other words, you had, that was the silliest thing, because troops would go out and they'd count everything. Every dead dog, everything else is a body count. And it got to be a game. It wasn't a war. And you were fighting the politicians all the time.
I had another point. Remember the Cuban Missile Crisis? I think that drew the country together for a few days. It really did. I had the feeling there that it was almost back like it was in World War II. And two times in President Reagan's administration, you know, the president, he could get up there in those State of the Union addresses and he could talk about little Johnny up there in the first row. And you go, wow, that's kind of patriotic. Sort of draws you together, but it's a short time. It didn't last 4 years like the big war did.
Everybody prepared to buy this hypothesis that in order for our country at least to have a sense of patriotism, there has to be this real or imagined threat of a common enemy?
I don't know. I really like this definition of patriotism as being responsible civically. And no, I don't think that takes a war. I don't know what it's going to take to bring our country together civically, be civically responsible. But I don't believe we have to go to war to do that.
What about the notion of this moral equivalent of war? I mean, something like Christine mentioned with folks up in Fargo, banding together with a kind of civic participation, because in this case there's a common enemy, but it's natural.
That was localized again. It wasn't the whole country, but I think it did a lot to make that our community feel very proud of itself. And in the sharing of the few tragedies that happened and in the sharing of that experience.
I think you misunderstand how much we all paid attention.
Yeah. I think so, too.
Every day we watched.
We did too.
To see how you were doing. It was a matter of great concern to everyone.
And prayer was just constant.
And our church sent money to somebody in North Dakota.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, you know, it was widespread. I think, you know, some Earth Days, I remember the first Earth Day. This was April 20th, 1970. And that was a real, I don't know if that was, I was still young to get a sense of how national that was, but that was a very strong national event, but maybe not so long-lived. But
that seems to me one of the possibilities for having a whole national work to do together would be to face the fact that we've got a huge environmental. It's just a long-term crisis. It's not that tomorrow somebody might bomb our city with this. It's something that's happening over a century, and if we were able to see how devastating that will be to the world, if we do nothing in a century, we could maybe gather together and work at it. And I've been quite surprised since that Earth Day how now recycling of things has become commonplace. There wasn't any such thing as recycling in 1970, and I know I shouldn't say there's no such thing, but it wasn't done on a street by street.
Yeah, curb.
Well, yeah. And so, it's never had the kind of intensity nationally.
Yes, sir.
Well, it's mentioned here that patriotism seems to have died off since World War II, but I think it's here just as much as everybody here. It just isn't needed until we perceive a common enemy. If the country had a common enemy, military threat, if the Cuban Missile Crisis would have gone the other way. Patriotism that I think would have come out in this country would have been equal to what happened in World War II. That's why Korea and the Vietnam War didn't have the outpouring of patriotism, because there was no perception of a common enemy, that the country wasn't threatened. But I think if the country was threatened, you'd see that patriotism rise just the way it did on December 7, 1941. I think it's here. It just isn't needed at the moment. But when we need it, it'll come up.
Well, let's hear a couple other people comment in connection, in response to what his point was, to Rachel's point, that there's been an erosion of confidence in American institutions, particularly the government. Larry?
Well, I think I just find it interesting to see in President Reagan's tenure in office the combination of a real resurgence in patriotism without a war, however, with a very strong sense of a real or imagined threat, namely communism. The combination of that resurgence in patriotism with a promotion of the distrust of federal government. And to be both anti-Washington and patriotic, this is an interesting combination.
It is very interesting.
That persists today.
Right? Yeah, it does.
So this is to echo the gentleman's sentiment that in your view there is a kind of resurgence begun under Reagan of patriotism, even though there's a persistent anti-federal government and cynicism, yeah. What Rachel mentioned about a cynicism.
Well, I think President Reagan carried it on through over a long period of time and took acute political and probably personal, and not personal advantage, but I mean, I think he deeply felt it. But he took advantage as a national leader to reap the response to having lost the war in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And so it was kind of patriotism tied to a resurgence and pride in America. It's mourning in America.
Mm-hmm. I just think that another interesting thing about is the media and how does the media affect what we think about politics or, you know, government or whatever. I mean, just if you even just think about the last 7-8 months, this whole Clinton scandal, like everything you ever hear about on the paper and on TV, reporters are always sensationalizing everything because that's what's sold. So you feel like you can't get an objective opinion on anything. At least that's how I feel. I feel like I just want to shut it off. I don't even want to hear about it because I don't trust anything that I'm hearing anymore.
That's
which
true.
I think, you know, it has to affect the American public. And I think, you know, if you take opinion polls, I think a lot of people, I mean, I think there have been some done on this whole Clinton deal. People are like, I don't care. I just want a good president, you know, and I agree with what he does on foreign policy or whatever. And I don't want to hear about all this stuff, but that's what the media reports on, and I think that has a definite effect on
it. I agree with that. I think a lot of the press are out to sell newspapers. That story sell, like Paparazzi chasing poor Princess Diana to death. That's what they want.
And yes. As long as we buy them, they'll continue.
Right.
Yeah.
Back here, Ms. Gentleman.
It just strikes me peculiar that patriotism has to be based on violence. Shouldn't it be based on respect for the institutions that your country has?
What is your best guess as to how we can be in this situation which some have suggested we're in? which is this peculiar combination of a resurgence of patriotism along with a growing cynicism about a particular set of institutions, that is the national government.
I don't know. Oh.
Yeah.
Yes, very sure. Well, I think sometimes patriotism comes across in more quiet ways. Like your statement there, I was thinking a time that I felt good about America, that didn't have to do with war, was when I was called for jury duty. And, you know, just seeing how the whole judicial system works, I thought, doggone, I'm glad I'm in America. You know, and it was just very fascinating to see, you know, the whole innocent until proven guilty, and that we kind of, you know, practice what we believe, and that was very uplifting to me. But yet, that's in a very silent way. It's not as a, I mean, it is a community effort, but it's not a the big thing where we all pull together. And maybe a lot of patriotism goes on a quieter level, day by day.
Nice point. I mean, there was a bunch of us last night sitting around talking in another group, and we compared our service on jury duty. And we all admitted that we wound up serving on juries, myself included, and coming out of that experience with a deeper regard for that particular process, but just generally for the country that had that kind of legal process, and watching our fellow citizens at work being able to make judgments and so on. So that's a nice point of Fred.
I find it helpful to distinguish between patriotism and nationalism.
Yeah.
You know, patriotism doesn't require that you compare yourself to anybody else. You just give thanks for and be proud and loyal to what you have, and like a judicial system that allows for fairness, and you don't sit around when you're on a jury and say, well, you know, thank God I wasn't in Germany. But nationalism is the game of our nation's better than your nation. You know, and that's where the ugly American comes from.
Nice point. Yes. Good. Bruce?
I guess I'm not sure that we should be too terribly unhappy that what a lot of people call patriotism isn't really in evidence. Obviously, when the country is challenged, these things happen. But it seems to me there's something different about the principles on which this nation was founded. I mean, while we all love the land, the country could exist without the land. Many cultures require that they be on that particular land. We certainly see that in the Middle East. This particular ground is what's important. But among the principles that make America what it is, one of them is everybody's free to do what they want. In other words, it's a kind of a loose idea that you don't have to have a lot of things in common. What you have to have is a principle that lets everybody do what they want. And so maybe we shouldn't be terribly surprised that when that system isn't being threatened, that everybody seems to be going off and doing their own thing, since that's in part what the country promised.
Another soft and quiet example is we got to adopt the girls in Guatemala. Just sitting through the naturalization process and realizing what an incredible gift and opportunity that we are given by our country, in this case, to allow that to happen. A very patriotic sense comes from that.
Okay. Yes. Michael.
Just to talk a bit about maybe patriotism, nationalism, the image the country projects. It's very interesting. I'm from Canada, from Saskatoon. Very interesting to speak with Canadians in terms of the kind of image that is projected in a movie like Air Force One. I mean, I'm sure in the U.S., Air Force One was, you know, just another fun action movie. But in Canada, I mean, it's either a comedy in terms of, we can't really imagine, for example, in Canada, the Prime Minister, you know, kicking butt. That's not why we elect the Prime Minister. So therefore, the other question comes in, somewhat a scary question, is what's going on in the U.S. that they're kind of even even if it's Hollywood, the illusion that somehow you want your president to be Rambo. You know, as a Canadian, how am I supposed to feel about that? How is the rest of the world supposed to feel about that when somehow you want Rambo as president? Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm wary. I mean, that's part of that ugly American or whatever, the macho American, I guess. That's not a comforting feeling. So let's hope that's a comedy.
Yes.
Well, it was interesting a couple of weeks ago to read about Nathan confronting David and thinking that, you know, sexual immorality is not new in political leaders. It's been around for a while. But in World War II, as I reflect on that, I'm proud of our country that we, especially when I look at the atrocities of the Holocaust, I'm saddened that we didn't get in sooner and stop it sooner. But what I'm most proud of in World War II is the Marshall Plan, where we went back in and rebuilt Europe, including the people who had started the war. You know, I mean, to me, that is a shining moment. And I think we are going to be judged in this half of the century because we did not do that with Russia. Because we were willing to spend billions of dollars to destroy them as a country, but not willing to spend hundreds of millions, or perhaps a billion, the cost of one bomber, to go in and help them rebuild the shattered economy. We will be judged, and I think we will pay hell. Because we made that, didn't make that decision, didn't have the courage to do it.
It's a good point.
Larry, someone else was in first here.
Oh, just a funny story.
Okay, go ahead. That's right. Go ahead. You first, and then Larry will give you the last word, and then we'll have to.
At the end of the war, his comment reminded me of the reporters were interviewing General Patton on the getting ready to reconstruct Germany. There was usually a lot of Germans in important jobs. And the reporters asked him, they said, "General, is it true that if your army was caught between the Germans on one side and the Russians on the other, you wouldn't know which way to attack?" He said, "Well, I never said that. Didn't say any such thing. Wish you had."
Yes, Larry.
That's just another point. I think perhaps one difference from earlier expressions of patriotism, let me put it differently, a lack of overt patriotism now may be that at some moments in our history, patriotism has taken the form of a kind of vision for America. I mean, I think the Civil Rights Movement was a very patriotically infused moment. I mean, when King says, "I have a dream," it was a dream about the nation. And there was a lot of resonance with it. And I, there may be immigrants today for whom that vision of America and for America is real, but for a lot of U.S. Americans, there isn't that stirring vision any longer. So, and that's a little different than simply mistrust or distrust of institutions, although that may affect it. Mm-hmm. And some of the cynicism may be because we didn't deliver on the civil rights, and the persistence of white racism continues, so that things that problems were judged in retrospect to be more intractable than we thought at the time. But I think it's probably true that there's a kind of quiet patriotism that shows up in many ways. But there may also simply be an absence of enthusiasm for a vision of what the country might be. That's the difference between the idealism that people saw in the Kennedy years and our own time. There isn't that idealism.
I think we're going to have to let that be the last word, and
hope that you leave here at least with some new thoughts about this, seeing how complex it is, the distinction, for example, between nationalism and patriotism, the suggestion from some that they think locally, and that gives them a sense of belonging, whether it's serving on a jury or doing the kind of work that Rachel does, or someone mentioned adopting some children from another country and watching the whole naturalization process and so forth and so on, something going on right within his own family. Old Edmund Burke's point about the little platoons, the neighborhoods and the people that you can see face to face, and a place that gives you the space to move and pursue individual goals, but collective goals too, and the encouragement to do that might be a kind of breeding ground for a kind of latent love for country that may spring into action, as this gentleman in the back suggested, collectively when there's a perceived or real common threat. But it's a complicated issue, particularly, as someone said, we've been through this weird experience of having a deepening cynicism about national institutions. At the same time, we have in some sense or other had a rise in patriotism. So thank you all on the panel for making this issue richer and more complex, and I wish you all a good night.